Board of Appeals. We only have one case on the docket, as I think you've figured out by the fact that y'all have taken your seats already. As you know, we each have, you each have 20 minutes to argue your case. We usually set aside 5 minutes for appellant's rebuttal, but I think that you've given a different time to the timekeeper, and whatever that is up to you and our timekeeper, so I'll let y'all, but you have done that, correct? Thank you. Our lighting system, green means go, yellow means slow down. You have 2 minutes left in your argument. When you see yellow, for you, regardless of where you are in your argument. So when you see 2 minutes, kind of be thinking about wrapping up. When you see red, that means you're out of time. Please feel free to continue answering whatever question has been posed, but going beyond that, please seek leave of court. The proceedings today are audio recorded. This is not for voice amplification, so for everyone in the back row, you're not going to be helped out by these. These are just for the audio recordings, and the audio recording will be available on the court's website within a day or two. My understanding is we're getting those up fairly quickly. Housekeeping: if anyone has a cell phone or other device that makes any noise or would distract from our attorney's arguments, please turn them off or put them in silent mode. And I think that is it. So we'll proceed by calling first for announcements, and then we'll let the lawyers begin with their argument. And this is cause number 18437CV, Lincoln Financial Advisors Corporation versus Bridget Ards, acting as next friend for her daughter, Gabrielle Ards. And for the appellant?
Andrew.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And for the appellee?
Lori Ratliff.
Okay. And Mr. Whitaker, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Whitaker. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Lincoln Financial Advisors Corporation. We're asking the court to reverse the order entered below denying our motion to compel arbitration and enter an order compelling the arbitration of the disputes between Bridget and Gabrielle on the one hand and on my client on the other hand. This case is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, and arbitration is required under that act when two elements are present. There's a valid and enforceable agreement to arbitrate, and the scope of the claims at issue are within that arbitration agreement. We believe both of those elements are established here. With respect to the existence of an arbitration agreement, there's clearly an arbitration agreement in both of the account agreements that the trustees have signed. So I think that's an easy question, but the sub-question underneath that is, are Bridget and Gabrielle bound by that arbitration provision? Texas law has recognized at least seven different ways that a non-party to an arbitration agreement can be bound, and we believe that at least four of those standards are implicated here: derivative status, third-party beneficiary, estoppel, and agency.
In this case, there's two arbitration agreements that were signed, correct?
Yes.
And you're trying to enforce both of them?
Yes.
Does it make any difference if it's one or the other, or?
We believe independently they can be satisfied, but we also believe that together they can be satisfied. For example, the first one provides that it applies to the successors of the initial account holder. So Brenda, the successor trustee, would be bound under the terms of the first agreement. But when Brenda signed the second agreement, after the first trustee, Carl III, was removed, she effectively established an account with us by signing that client profile, and that agreement contains its own arbitration provision within it. So I think we can go under either one or under both.
Does Lincoln Financial allow client profiles to be set up without signing an arbitration agreement?
I believe that that is a routine, non-negotiable aspect of not only our account arrangements, but pretty much any financial firm that plays in that ballpark these days. But there's no evidence in the record of that, Your Honor, but I believe that is a standard form provision in our account agreements.
Yes.
So the four ways that we believe Bridget and Gabrielle are bound, the first of which is derivative status. In this case, in the original petition, Bridget, acting on behalf of Gabrielle, seeks to sue derivatively on behalf of the trustee, claiming that she had made demand upon the successor trustee to go after the first trustee. The second trustee failed to do so, so she wants to proceed derivatively. Whenever you elect to proceed derivatively, and we cite a couple of cases to this effect, for example, in the wrongful death context or in the corporate context, you have the right to proceed derivatively, you're allowed to proceed derivatively, but when you do so, you take the good with the bad. And so you become the corporation, you become the trustee.
So would she then be kind of suing herself?
Well, she would be suing on behalf of the trust, basically, the trustees for misconduct. So really, there's no allegation that the second trustee engaged in any misconduct other than failing to do what they wanted to do in terms of going after the first trustee. Whereas the factual allegation is that the first trustee absconded with funds.
Does that relate back to Justice Smith's question about which signature act that we're talking about?
I don't really think it does, Your
Honor.
I think that this, you know, that they are suing effectively, suing derivatively, complaining of the second trustee's failure to go after the first trustee. But the teaching here is, regardless of the factual underpinnings of that claim, she's trying to be the trustee, therefore she is bound by the trustee's account agreements. And the Supreme Court recently made that clear in the Labatt Food Service case, which was a wrongful death case, where they said, yes, the beneficiaries who are seeking to sue for wrongful death are barred by the arbitration agreement entered into by the decedent. And so here they admitted in their brief, standing is predicated on Gabrielle's beneficiary status. They're seeking to sue derivatively, and they want to recover damages for the benefit of the trust. All of the hallmarks of a derivative claim here are met. On that ground alone, Bridget and Gabrielle are bound by the arbitration provision. The second independent ground is that of third-party beneficiary. In the will, the decedent, who was Gabrielle's grandfather, set up a trust, appointed his son, Carl III, as the beneficiary of that trust. After his death, Carl jumped in, assumed status as the trustee, and opened up an account. The account was opened by Carl in the name of the Gabrielle Ards Trust. And we, in turn, open the account in the name of Carl Ards III as trustee of the Gabrielle Ards Trust under the will dated June of 2008. So under that approach, the benefits of the trust are for Gabrielle. It was opened up for her benefit, and she is clearly bound as a third-party beneficiary to that. Now, in the brief, Bridget and Gabrielle cite a couple of cases in which the claims of children are found not to be arbitrable. And those cases are readily distinguishable. For example, in the Fleetwood Enterprises case, which was a Fifth Circuit case, the parents bought an RV. And then the RV had some problems. The kids and the parents both asserted claims underneath it. And the court didn't have any difficulty at all saying the kids are not, you know, the parents did not act on behalf of the kids in buying that RV. They weren't the intended beneficiaries of it. The parents were. Here, the only person for whom the account was opened is Gabrielle. She is the beneficiary of that account, and she is the reason why it was opened. Then the other case cited in their brief is that of SSP Partners, which was an occupational accident case, where the mom signed, as part of her employment, an agreement that had an arbitration provision in it, and when she was injured, she asserted claims that had to be arbitrated, but her kids' claims were independent of that, and they were not considered to be a third-party beneficiary of that. Now, the two critical cases, I think, for the court's consideration, and we cite them in every brief we filed so far in this case, are that of Merrill Lynch versus Eddings and the Ameriprise versus Farias case. Those are the only two Texas cases addressing the arbitrability of the claims of a trust beneficiary arising out of misconduct by the trustee in that account. And in both cases, the courts easily held that those claims were arbitrable. And we haven't seen a single case to date cited by either Bridget or Gabrielle suggesting that the claims of a trust beneficiary are not arbitrable under these circumstances.
Are you familiar with the Weekly case out of the Supreme Court?
I believe so, Your Honor.
What impact does the Weekly case have on, say, the Merrill Lynch Eddings case?
Well, I think they actually cite Eddings favorably in Weekly in support of the notion that they can be bound, because to allow a beneficiary to not be bound by the arbitration provision would effectively gut what the state has decided is a strong presumption in favor of arbitration. So in the Weekly case, Your Honor, the arbitration agreement was signed by Dad, who was buying a house, he elected subsequently to transfer that to a trust in which the daughter was the beneficiary, So she was, so the daughter then suffered personal injuries. I mean, she was in a house that made her sick. So the claims are not related at all to the contract that she's asserting, But the court, and it's an important distinction, too, that I think Justice...
So, that's what I was just going to ask is, so do you think it matters? And if so, where Bridget's claims originate?
It's important. In Weekly, and this is an estoppel case. Weekly's an estoppel case,
correct,
which is our third element that we haven't talked about yet. And basically, estoppel is predicated on the notion that if a party is going to seek benefits under a contract, it takes all of the contract, not just the parts it wants to take. So in some cases, under the estoppel notion, a party will sue under the contract. A non-party will nonetheless assert a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and so therefore they're estopped because they're alleging the breach, they're bound by the arbitration provision. Weekly was not that case. She was definitely not asserting a breach of contract claim. She was asserting a personal injury claim, and the court nonetheless held, because other circumstances supported the notion that she had, outside of the lawsuit, sought to benefit from the contract, she was bound by the contract even though her claims were not under the contract. And so this was a distinction that I believe Justice Baker recognized in the case that was issued by y'all after the briefing closed, the Toll Dallas versus Dusing case, D-U-S-I-N-G, where that dichotomy was recognized and that a party was found to be bound to an arbitration provision because they had sought outside of the lawsuit to benefit from that contract. And having done so, they were, so here, this dovetails back, Justice Goodwin, to the derivative status. I mean, they are suing here to, on behalf of the trust, to recover monies paid out from this account. They want to get that money put back into the account, and she's the beneficiary of that. And so that was important to the Supreme Court in the Weekly Homes case, because when the house was transferred from Dad to the trust, daughter was the beneficiary of that trust. And so the court found it, worth noting in its opinion that her status as the beneficiary provided further support for the notion that she was seeking to benefit under that contract and that her claim should be arbitrable as well. So I guess that, so third party beneficiary is number two. That's basically estoppel. Number three is the third reason why Gabrielle and Bridget should be bound. And in our briefing, we cite not only Farias and Eddings, which hold third-party beneficiary estoppel as being bound, but in our reply brief, we also cite five cases from out of state in which trust beneficiaries are found to be bound by the arbitration agreements in the account agreements the trustees entered into on their behalf. Seven cases total, and we have not seen a single case to the contrary holding that a trust beneficiary is not so bound.
So what about the fact that she's a minor?
Well,
does that impact the analysis that either that you have to engage in or that this court should engage in? Because let's think about it. If she signed the agreement herself, it would certainly be voidable because she's a minor. It seems kind of, there's something amiss here, it seems.
Well, I respectfully just, I agree and I disagree, Your Honor, in terms of whether she had signed it. Both of the account agreements require a certification that she is over 18. In order to be a signatory to the account agreement, we insist that the individual be over 18, because we know the perils associated with doing business with a minor. I mean, you enter into a contract with a minor, and then the minor decides when she turns 18 that that wasn't a good idea, you're having to pay all over again, okay? Right. So our account agreements will not allow us to do business with a minor. And in fact, one of the pages in Carl's agreement actually suggested that she was to be an account holder, and that page was marked through because we don't do that. Okay? Now, I realize that they cite this Pack Foods case versus Garcia, which I think out of one of the South Texas Courts of Appeals, where a 16-year-old, as part of her job, had signed a contract with an arbitration provision in it, and then she decided later she didn't want to be bound by it, and you're right. There are Texas cases saying that those folks are not bound. But here, we were dealing with a nominal party, but the party who had the authority here is the trustee. So, I mean, Texas law has lots of different ways, be it a guardian of the estate, for example, or here, proceeding as next friend, which is a little subset of that, or proceeding as a trustee, where arrangements with minors who have somebody ostensibly looking after them, okay, are binding, because otherwise you could never deal with an individual like that. So, I see I'm out of time.
May it please the court, Laurie Ratliff on behalf of the appellee. I want to just quickly mention one thing before it leaves me, and that is it's very clear that you're bound by what you put in your motion to compel arbitration. And you heard him say there are four reasons. I would ask the court to look at their motion to compel because it only raises two. It raises direct benefits, estoppel, and it raises third-party beneficiary. And their cases are clear. You can't come in now on appeal and say, here are all these other grounds I could have raised in the trial court. So I just want to make that point very clear. But I want to start with, you know, when you look at all these non-signatory cases, it becomes really clear from Texas Supreme Court precedent that it requires a very specific and high level of proof for a movement to take a right to a jury trial away in favor of arbitration. And I'm not talking about I'm changing the standard of review. I'm just talking about if you read the language, take third-party beneficiary, for example. What does a movement have to show? They have to show that the account agreement clearly and fully expresses an intent to confer a benefit on a third party, and that contract was entered directly for the third party's benefit. The language right there shows you what I'm talking about, a higher level. You can't create a third-party beneficiary contract by implication. In fact, the cases are clear, the presumption is against finding a third-party beneficiary contract. And direct benefits estoppel is no different. A movement has to show that the plaintiff's claims depend on the contract, and they have to show that liability is tied solely to the contract. So this is a high level for a movement to take away someone's right to a jury trial. And you can see that that makes sense, right? I mean, if you're going to take away someone's right to a jury to arbitrate when they didn't participate in the negotiations, they didn't even know about the arbitration clause or the contract. So you can see why the Supreme Court is using very higher level of proof by a movement to take away a right to a jury trial. And I wouldn't normally want to do this in this context, but I think it's really important to look at the account agreement. The account agreement is attached to my brief, is at tab C. I know it's attached to their brief as well. But it's important to understand the only thing that this court can look at is the account agreement. You heard them say, well, what does the will say over here and what does our petition say over here? That's in their brief. But the problem is, all that matters is the intent of the parties who entered the contract, which is Lincoln and Carl Ards III. I wasn't a party to that, so you can't use my petition. I didn't participate in that. And you can't use the will of Carl Ards Jr. He didn't participate in that. So all you can look at is this account agreement, and it's really pretty easy to look at to see why Judge Herman saw this and said this is not a clear intent to create a third-party beneficiary contract. On the first page of the contract, again, this is in the record at 58. I'm sorry that I didn't bring a copy for you, but you can see that Carl Ards III signed as himself individually as the primary account holder. This is on the first page of the account agreement. And right above that, and I know I had to take off my glasses to read it, it's so small, but right above that, when it's giving the instructions for the account holder, it says, tell us something about yourself, such as whether you're a trustee. That's actually in the line right here. Are you a trustee? Are you a guardian? Are you an administrator? What capacity are you acting in? And Carl Ards III signs it individually. Not a word about being a trustee. You look at the second page, that's the only place they mention the Gabrielle Ards Trust as an entity account information. They put that right there. But you flip over a couple of pages more, primary beneficiaries, it's blank. Not one beneficiary is named. And I know they want to make light of this, but the page in the account agreement, the only place where it lists Gabrielle Ards individually is marked out. She's listed on here as an additional account holder, and it's marked out. And so you have to consider all this agreement and whether there's intent to create a third-party beneficiary in this document. And I submit this page alone probably gets you there, that there was no intent to create a third-party beneficiary. But when you flip over to the next page, again, Carl Ards III signs off on the account agreement individually and doesn't sign off as trustee. And think about what it would have taken to show intent, clear intent, like the Supreme Court says you have to have. He could have signed it as trustee. He could have signed off on it saying, I'm doing this on behalf of my daughter, the beneficiary of the Gabrielle Ards Trust.
So is your position that if something would have been as simple as just saying, as trustee,
absolutely.
That would have been
enough. And it prompted him on the first page. On the first page, it says, let us know if you're serving as a trustee or an administrator, a guardian, whatever capacity you might be acting in. And I want to point out this case that they cite so much, Ameriprise versus Farias. And I want to say just one thing first. That case is almost 6 years old. It has never been cited by an appellate court or any court. If you hop on Westlaw, it's only cited in briefs. No court has ever cited that opinion. But if that opinion had two reasons why the court found a third-party beneficiary, and I want to talk about the second one. I'll get to the first one a little bit later. But the second one was because the beneficiaries were listed as the primary account holder. They were on the account. It was their account. And so that was the whole turning point for that court to say this is a third-party beneficiary, which, of course, we don't have in this case. Now, if you look at direct benefits estoppel and whether our claims, I know Justice Goodwin was alluding to this earlier, what's the basis of our claim? Well, to have direct benefits estoppel apply and take away my client's right to a jury, our claims have to be based on the account agreement. Solely, entirely, that's it. We live or die by this piece of paper. And if you read our petition has nothing to do with this. We're based on common law principles, one of them from 1911, which holds a bank holding fiduciary funds can be responsible when those fiduciary funds go out the door. And so none of our claims are based on that, and their liability is not based on this document. Their liability is based on common law and statutory provisions. Now, they put in their brief, well, what about the limits of responsibility? There's some paragraph in this account agreement that talks about limiting Lincoln's responsibility. Well, that could be nothing more than limiting the responsibility as between Lincoln and an account holder. It's nothing to do with what a third party, Gabrielle, in our case, is here for.
But the trust itself was created in response to these account agreements, correct?
No, it's the other way around. I mean, the will created the trust for Gabrielle Ards. Then Carl Ards III went to Lincoln to set up the account.
So it was the account that was set up because of these agreements?
No. I mean, Carl Ards III was named the trustee of the trust that was created in the will. It didn't tell him to go to Lincoln or go to, you know, Merrill Lynch. It just said, here's money set aside for Gabrielle Ards to be put into a trust. He chose to go to Lincoln. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Well, I guess that what I'm saying is we heard from the appellant that they wouldn't have set up a trust without signing these documents. And so it was the signing of these documents that created created the account that that's at issue here. And so I'm just wondering, it seems like this agreement here is somehow connected to kind of what you're going at. I mean, without signing this agreement, there wouldn't be this relationship between Lincoln Financial and Carl and Brenda.
But there are cases that talk about that that I cited in the brief. The most recent one is Jody James Farms out of the Supreme Court from last year. And that one talks about direct benefits estoppel. It's not enough to just say, well, there's a contract that's at issue here. We refer to a contract. This kind of relates to a contract. You have to base all of your claim on that. And we don't make any allegation about bad investment, poor investment advice, anything like that. All of our claims are purely non-contractual. Most of them are tort-related, but they're certainly non-contractual. They have nothing to do with this account agreement. And I want to go back to a point, and I think it was Justice Goodwin that raised it, about being a minor. I mean, this is the worst possible situation to take away someone's right to a jury trial in favor of arbitration. You have a minor who has to be represented by a parent. She's also a beneficiary who should be represented by a trustee, but this trustee put the money in his pocket. A successor trustee comes in. Successor trustee, by statute, is supposed to take care of the breaches of fiduciary duty by its predecessor, and she said no. And so it wasn't for my client's mother to come in. This claim would never have seen the light of day. And so this is the worst example of that situation. And I think that lets me lead into about the derivative issue, because I think that's an important part of this. So I think nobody's seeing what really is at issue here. And the starting point is this. Whose claim is it? Who was hurt here? It's the trust estate. The trust estate is the one that's harmed, and necessarily the beneficiary of that trust. And then the issue becomes standing and capacity, right? Standing, who's the person that's harmed? Well, it's a trust. Well, a trust is not a legal entity. It can't do anything. A minor can't do anything as a beneficiary. So they, while they have standing, they lacked capacity to bring the lawsuit. So the lawsuit, the capacity was with the trustee. The trustee should have been, successor trustee, should have been the one with capacity to bring the lawsuit. But she chose not to do that. So the fact that we use the word derivative is not derivative in the sense of wrongful death and our claim is based on somebody else's claim. The claim belongs to the trust estate and necessarily Gabrielle, the beneficiary. We're not stepping in on behalf of the trustee's claim. The trustee and the successor trustee have no claim. So it's not a derivative claim in that sense where you're having to step in and take over somebody else's cause of action. It was our cause of action. But the problem was capacity, right? A minor can't sue. She doesn't have capacity. A trust is not a legal entity. It can't sue, so a trustee has to bring it. So it's wrong in my mind to hang up on the word derivative in our petition. That's not really what it's talking about. But I want to go one step further on that, and I think this shows the problem with their argument about derivative standing. Because their argument is, by the fact that we filed a lawsuit, we're now bound by that provision in the account agreement's right to arbitrate. Well, does that mean that my client could call up Lincoln tomorrow and say, well, gosh, you're going to treat me like the account holder and the trustee. I'll take the money and I'll go invest it somewhere else. They're not going to agree to that. I mean, they want to pick out that one paragraph and say, you can arbitrate, but you don't get any other benefit of that contract. And that's exactly the opposite of the policy the Supreme Court set out in direct benefits estoppel. That's the case that says you can have your contract, but you can't defeat it too. You get it all or nothing. And so that's why this derivative thing, to me, is a red herring. It has nothing to do with what's really at issue here. The damage was to the trust estate and necessarily to Gabrielle. We're not taking over somebody else's claim. Now I want to go back, talk a little bit more about Farias before I get to some of my cases. That's the case they want to rely on out of Corpus, and as I said, that's never been cited by a court anywhere. But there are two things that are very different about that case than what we have here. And I'm sure y'all are all familiar with this. There are such things as called a court-created trust, right? Plaintiff personal injury is a good example. Kids come into a lot of money. The court can say, okay, I'm directing that a trust be set up for these children and put in so-and-so as trustee. They put in lots of detail. It's in Chapter 142 in the Trust Code is where he talks about trust, court-created trust. And that, if you look at the opinion from the Corpus Court, it's very short. They had two reasons for finding third-party beneficiary. And the first one, they said, first, this is a court-created trust, right? That was important to them. And I know he's going to get up in rebuttal and say that doesn't matter, but in the Corpus Christi Court's mind, that was the number one reason for their holding. And their second reason, as I said earlier, the account agreement was set up with the beneficiaries as the primary account holder, not like our case where it's set up as an individual account.
The language it says for the sole benefit of.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why FARIUS doesn't have any meaning for the court's issue here. Eddings, the case out of Waco, it's kind of an old case now. It's surprising to say that from 92 is actually old. But in that case, the problem, to me, there were two things. The trust actually had an arbitration clause, which is unusual. There was also an arbitration clause with the Merrill Lynch account, and that was really the main arbitration clause that was at issue. But the problem with that case, and again, I'm sorry to have to look at this, but I think it's important to see this. The court said all of the claims underlying the account agreement is the underlying basis for all the claims. They have no claims had the account agreement never been signed. And the opinion never tells you what the claims are. They just say they're all within the account. They have this throwaway paragraph at the end of this at the end of the case saying, well, you can't call it a tort and get away with it. So you just can't definitively say that this case was dealing with the same kind of claim that we're raising. And again, the Waco court, for whatever reason, thought that they could just rely on the policy of arbitration to decide whether there was an arbitration agreement in the beginning, and that's not what you can do. Now, turning to some of the cases, of course, I want to talk about the one, Justice Goodwin, that you wrote a year and a half ago that I think is very important for the court's analysis here. That's the Cardin Healthcare versus Goldberg. That's the Shame on Seton Hospital case. I'm sure y'all know the facts of that one, but in any event, Goldberg got shorted by the hospital from the insurance money. Hospital ends up coming after her for not paying, even though she had her insurance company, health insurance had paid and her car insurance had paid, and Seton took the bigger money and then stuck her with the rest. But in any event, there was, of course, an arbitration clause between Seton and Blue Cross. So when Blue Cross comes in and says, we're going to not give you very much money, that's okay, but there's an arbitration clause. So when Goldberg sued for fraud and DTPA, leave me alone, hospital, they tried to invoke the arbitration clause. And certainly it sounded a little bit like direct benefits estoppel, right? Because as Seton argued, well, gosh, she's not going to be able to create a damage model without looking at our contract with Blue Cross. How can she possibly maintain this claim? And this court, Justice Goodwin, rejected that and said, Goldberg's asserted statutory and common law claims that arose from Seton's conduct toward Goldberg, independent of any kind of contract with Blue Cross. And so there was no direct benefits estoppel. And that's exactly what we're saying here. Our complaint is Lincoln's conduct towards us has nothing to do with their account agreement between Lincoln and Carl Ards III. The other case I would point out to the court, two of them, Jody James Farms versus Altman, I think that's a very important direct benefits estoppel case because that's another one that makes it look like they needed the contract. That was a crop damage claim, and in that case, what I call the big insurance company and the policyholder had an arbitration clause, but the defendant was the local insurance agent, that's who got sued, who tried to invoke that arbitration clause. And it looked like the policyholder was going to seek a damage amount that was based on the contract, right? I mean, here's the contract, here's what I should have gotten covered, so I'm suing for it. And so it looked like direct benefits estoppel. And the court said no. Just because you're seeking a measure of loss that may have come from a contract calculation, the direct benefits did not apply just because it refers to a contract. So I think that case is instructive, but again, it shows claims can be non-contractual, which in that case, they were clearly non-contractual cases. The last case I would mention quickly is SSP Partners. That was discussed a little bit earlier. I think that case is very instructive for a couple of reasons. That has an arbitration clause that purported to bind successors, subsidiaries, assigns, beneficiaries, heirs, children, spouse, parents, legal representative, trying to get everybody that they could. But it turns out the court in that case disagreed with that and said no. And it was a non-subscriber case where they said the mother never entered this contract for the benefit of the children. And I see I'm running out of time, and so I would ask the court to affirm Judge Herman's ruling, finding that my client is entitled to go to a jury trial and not to have to go to arbitration. Thank you.
May it please the court, a few observations here. We are still awaiting a case from the other side holding that the claims of a trust beneficiary are not subject to arbitration. All seven of the cases that have been cited so far arising out of anything approaching this fact pattern, the courts, including in Farias and in Eddings, have held that those claims are arbitrable. With respect to the briefing error observation at the beginning, if the court will go back and look at our reply brief before the trial court at 116-117, we raised the derivative issue. We argued it on the reporter's record at pages 8 and 30. We raised it in our opening brief here, our reply brief here, and they have never made any sort of waiver argument prior to oral argument here today.
So, but it is contained in your reply brief to the trial court below.
Pages 116 and 117, we talk about the derivative status. And the fourth element we raised, we didn't argue earlier, was that of agency.
Agency.
And I think that that is in there somewhere as well, that she, you know, that Carl was acting on her behalf. With respect to the account agreement from Carl, I am perhaps missing something here, but on page one of his account agreement, he sets this up as an entity account on the right-hand side of the page as trust under will. Then beneath that, under the section two primary account holder, he circles trustee on the right-hand side of the page. Then on the third page, he indicates the entity account information is the Gabrielle Ards Trust. I mean, this trust was set up for her benefit pursuant to the will.
Well, but I think the argument that I heard is, okay, certainly there's a notice. You know, if this was just a notice question, I think that we wouldn't maybe be here. But I think it's also, is there clear and unequivocal language demonstrating the right or the intent to grant either Gabrielle or the trust the right to be the claimant? Is that, am I?
Well, I mean, the test is, do the contracting parties indicate an intent to benefit the third party?
I thought it was to intend to grant Gabrielle or the trust the right to be the claimant, not just to benefit them, but the
no.
right.
I believe, with all due respect, and I think the test is...
Well, that's what we're doing here. That's why we're trying to seek clarification.
Did the contracting parties intend to benefit her? That's element one. And enter into the contract for her benefit. So the only reason why this trust custodial account is being set up is because Carl, pursuant to the will, has hundreds of thousands of dollars for which he is to serve as the trustee for Gabrielle.
Okay, so let me back up then. What act between Carl and LFA are they hanging their hat on the agreement between Carl and LFA, are they hanging their hat on?
Carl submitted the application asking to open up a trust account for the benefit of the Gabrielle Ards Trust.
Sure.
We then accept that offer by opening the account, and the account is in the name of Carl Ards III, trustee for the Gabrielle Ards Trust under will dated June 27, 2008.
Right.
So that trust designates Gabrielle as the beneficiary. The will does. Mm-hmm. So she is the beneficiary of that trust. And I thought it was interesting when Ms. Ratliff was attempting to get away from the derivative argument, bearing in mind that derivative is the term they used in their petition to characterize their client, what they wanted to do in this action, to step into the shoes of the trustee. She also makes the argument that at the end of the day, all of this is for the benefit of who? Gabrielle. And that just speaks volumes. That is who this is for. And the third party beneficiary, who else? I mean, This was set up precisely because she was a minor. The trust itself says that this money is to remain under the control of the trust, except for limited expenditures, health, education, welfare, until she turns 25 or 35, when the money can then be handed off to her. But at the time, she was a minor, and Granddad clearly set this up for her benefit. And that's why this account was set up, for her benefit.
Well, but I think the trust also gives the complete discretion, and it has some very, you know, very liberal language in terms of what the trustee could do in terms of the management of the trust. And let me ask you even a more important question. Can we look, do you agree with Ms. Ratliff that we can or cannot look at the trust itself in determining where we are here today? Do we just look at the agreement?
I think under the third-party beneficiary argument, okay, there is some authority that suggests that has to appear from the four corners of that agreement, okay? Derivative status.
Of the agreement between Carl and LFA.
Right, right.
Okay.
Derivative status, you know, by definition has to come from somewhere else because they're asking to step into the shoes. So, you know, that's not going to appear in the agreement. So the evidentiary sort of parole evidence argument she's trying to make, I believe applies only to the third party beneficiary element that we're trying to establish, has nothing to do with derivative status, has nothing to do, quite frankly, with estoppel either, because estoppel considers all kinds of other factors that are floating around out there, things that happened before, things that happened after, okay? The one issue I have not addressed yet, and I see I'm out of time, is, I'm finished.
Yeah, quickly.
Is the second part of the test is whether or not the claims arise under the arbitration agreement. Not whether or not the claims relate to the account agreement or anything like that. That's the test for estoppel. The test is you read the arbitration provision, clearly those cover conduct in the account. So if she is bound, then arbitration is required.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you both for a very helpful argument. And with that, the case will be submitted and this court will stand in recess.